This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.
Well, good evening. Great to be back in the hot seat here at Love Sport Radio. I've got three shows for you this evening. Switching things around a little bit. Love Sport Review is up first, you know, first hour this evening up until 8 p.m. Going to look back at the big stories. Naturally, from the week just gone, loads to talk about, isn't there? Going to start, well, we're going to try to do a few football stories within this first hour because, you know, we do so many other football stories throughout the rest of the shows and the days. So up first, we're going to do Wimbledon. Coco Gauff is naturally going to be dominating that chat, as will Andy Murray. How good is it? How nice is it to see Andy Murray back at Wimbledon, back playing tennis and winning? I mean, we just hoped to see him again, didn't we, in some capacity? But I wouldn't go as far as saying he looks as good as ever, but he certainly looks like he could be sticking around for a little while yet, which is so nice to see. And would it be great as well if we saw a Murray hit it off in one of these finals at Wimbledon, taking on his brother Jamie, as we know is so good within the double. Andy is partnered up with Serena Williams and Pierre Hugerbert in the men's mixed. Two wins for him kicking off that week. And as I said, 15-year-old tennis sensation Coco Gauff. It's incredible, isn't it? You know, I'm in my late 20s and I cast my mind back when I was 15 years old. And then you think, what was I doing when I was 15? What was I like at sport? What was I just like as a person? Well, I'll tell you what, it's pretty special, isn't it, to see someone competing with grown women at professional sport, and not just competing and being there, beating them. It's almost a miracle. It's special, and it really is. I was here in Love Sport the other day when she won her third round match, and we thought that it was over, didn't we? She lost the first set, she was struggling in the second, saving match points, and she turned it around. She saved those match points, and then she went on to win the tie, which was, as I say, absolutely incredible, so special. And Roger Federer as well, 37 years old, 37 again, complete other end of the spectrum, but almost a medical miracle, isn't it? Again, you talk about a 15-year-old being able to compete with these women. What a 37-year-old man. Just a complete level above. A complete level above all these other men. And he's an absolute joy to watch, isn't it? I've always been a big fan of tennis. But I think at times I've struggled to really kind of buy into someone like Rafa Nadal. I think for the same reason maybe other people have struggled at times with Andy Murray over the years. It's a personality thing, isn't it? And Roger, he comes across as just the classiest of people, of men, both on and off the court. And at 37 years old, again, no real signs of slowing down. No real signs of slowing down. In the Women's World Cup today, the USA won it for a record fourth time. Megan Rapinoe scoring from the penalty spot, and then Ross Lavelle scoring the second. Both goals in the second half. I mean, if there's any consolation for the English women, it is to lose to the winners, isn't it? And you just can't help but feel, if England had been on the other side of that draw, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing and you have no control over these things. If that had happened, that England could have been in that final and against the US, because the US, they're so far ahead, aren't they? They are just so far ahead. So we'll do that, and then we'll do a couple of football stories as well. Frank Lampard joining Derby County, going to be joined by Jonathan Kidd from the Chelsea Fancast, a regular voice on the Chelsea Fan Show. Also, hopefully do a bit of Philip Cocu talk. What a signing that is. If Lampard leaves, which he obviously has done, to go to Chelsea, to be replaced by a guy who has won Dutch titles, has played over 100 times for his national side, and a Barcelona star. To get Philip Cocu in the championship is a hell of a coup. It's a coup. It's absolutely brilliant by Derby. And also Gary Monk. This is an incredible story. Sacked, wasn't he, by Birmingham. Everyone sat there thinking, he's been so harshly treated here. What has gone on? And then there was a very strange interview that the chief executive did in The Times. And he questioned his relationship with James Featherstone, his agent. And off the back of that, Middlesbrough then said, actually, we were a little bit uncomfortable with his relationship with this agent as well. And then off the back of that, The Leeds United owner, former owner Massimo Cellino, then came out and said, yeah, the same. We banned this agent from the football club. So Gary Monk here looks like he is in a whole heap of trouble about his relationship with his agent and whether he benefited financially. That's certainly the implications, or certainly being levelled at him. We shall have to wait and see, but we're hoping to speak to a couple of Birmingham fans as well before the end of the show and get their take on what is a rather intriguing story, because if it all comes out to be true, it's very, very unlikely you'd see Gary Monk managing at the top level again. That's my take on it anyway. But anyway, we're going to start with tennis. We are going to start with tennis. Wimbledon is very much up and away, about to head into the second week. We are joined by tennis expert George Belcher on the phone now. George, very good evening.
Evening.
So, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Coco or Murray?
Yeah, Coco's the big story, I think.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, isn't it? George, what were you doing when you were 15?
That is a good question. Some of the stuff's not very appropriate to say on air, I imagine. No, I mean, she's, you know, already just looks so naturally gifted as a star, you know, handles the pressure so well. It's really nice actually seeing these players at a young age when they come through. I think we'll all look back in kind of 10 years when I suspect she's won multiple Grand Slam titles. And I think we'll look back quite fondly on this week. You know, she's just a girl. She's just laughing. She finds the whole thing kind of weird, bit of fun. seems very nice, you know, not corrupted by the kind of sporting world and, you know, what's going to happen to her. You know, she's pretty clear already. She's going to be a global superstar. You know, she's just amazed by Michelle Obama tweeting about her and, you know, Will Smith's son tweeting her. And she's calling that like the highlight of her Wimbledon so far. When, she's beaten Venus Williams, got to the second week of Wimbledon. I mean, it's a crazy story.
Yeah. No. So, you know, as someone who is much more in the know than I, did people know of this prodigious talent before Wimbledon? Nobody would have expected it maybe to beat Venus, but did people know of this star already?
Yeah. So, I mean, she's been breaking a lot of records in the junior game, which I'm sure you could have probably guessed given how well she's doing now on the senior stage at such a young age. So she was the youngest ever US Open finalist at 13, in the juniors, that is,
wow.
Not in the seniors.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd heard about her then. I think the American scene had known about her even before that. She was the youngest ever player to win a USTA, which is kind of our version of the LTA. Sorry, America's version of the LTA. She was the youngest player to win a kind of national under-18s title. She did that at 12. So she's been known there for that. Then she won Junior French Open at 14. And I think she was like the fifth youngest Junior Grand Slam winner and the youngest since Martina Hingis.
Yeah.
So people have known about her in the kind of youth circles. But, you know, while we've all been kind of expecting her to make the transition, you know, the modern day and age, you almost didn't kind of think it was still possible for a 15-year-old to come through with the kind of advancements in physical technology and sports science. You maybe think, you know, it takes a little bit more to be athletically ready. But she's proving us all wrong, and I just think she's a terrific player. You never know quite what's going to happen from this point. You know, her life's going to change quite dramatically now. There's going to be a new set of pressure on her. You know, she'll arrive at the US Open later this year as a kind of big hope for America now, even though she's probably not realistically ready to win a Grand Slam just yet. So, you know, there's going to be an adjustment period, but I think everyone's pretty confident this girl's going to be the next big thing. And, you know, what a great time for her to be coming in when Serena Williams' career is kind of winding down.
Yeah.
You know, if it was possible to get them in a Grand Slam final, I'm not sure that will happen, but that would be a mega kind of generational shift. So, you know, fantastic story, and I'm looking forward to seeing where she goes from here.
Yeah, and whilst, you know, taking absolutely nothing away from any of this achievement, it's not that uncommon, is it, to see a teenager, particularly the women's side of the draw, come through. And not only come through, you know, actually win titles. I mean, you think of Maria Sharapova when she came through. You know, you mentioned Martina Hingis and also Anna Ivanovic. These things have happened before. But what I find slightly... or an interesting kind of point within this is that they haven't gone on to dominate. Like, say, for instance, I feel that on the men's side, if somebody was to come through and was winning titles at 18, 19, it'd be very likely they'd go on to dominate, where they don't particularly do that with the women's. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. I think the women typically do come through that little bit earlier than the men, and I think mentally it's probably a bit more of a strain. I mean, it seems still pretty unthinkable, but if she was to win Wimbledon this year, I mean, that would be just utterly, utterly life-changing. And I think sometimes when something that big happens too young to you, it's not necessarily a good thing. You know, maybe you kind of start thinking, oh, I've already done all the work. You're not mature enough to kind of handle it. Whereas if you win your first slam as a 20-year-old, for example, you've already kind of been on the tour for a few years, understood how it works, you know, dealt with a few losses. You know, if she's just going to walk in and win a Grand Slam title, that could maybe have a kind of negative effect on her mentality. I mean, in Sharapova's case, you'd probably say the reason she's not dominated has been Serena, really. I mean, that rivalry's kind of killed her off. I mean, she's still won 5 slams, so she's not done badly, but no. You feel with her, she'd have won double that if she wasn't playing in an era with a rival who's just completely dominated her on the court. So, you know, Hingis as well, I think, you know, she won, I can't remember the exact number, but she got towards double figures, like I think about 7 slams. So, you know, neither of them have done badly, but Coco, I'm sure people will be looking at her and thinking, crikey, she's going to win like 20, which, you know, isn't it always straightforward? And there are other good girls coming up. You know, we talked about Osaka at the start of the year, winning back-to-back slams. And she's had a bit of a dip now, but people still expect her to be around. So I think it's just good for the women's game that we're seeing these kind of young stars getting a bit more kind of global recognition. And I'm sure, you know, they're going to be big characters that kind of transcend the sport, which is what tennis needs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's talk about Andy then, shall we? A couple of wins in the men's, partnered up with Pierre Hugobert. And obviously in the mix, you mentioned Serena, partnered up with her. I mean, we saw, well, we certainly got a taste, didn't we, at Queens, where Andy was at. And I mean, it didn't just surprise us, it surprised himself, didn't it? I mean, it is an incredible story, isn't it, to see him not only out there, but to be looking as, not as good as ever, but do you know what I mean? Really, really kind of proving that he's still very much got it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think for most of us, we're almost not, I think from a kind of tennis side, there's a lot of people who aren't necessarily so interested in his doubles now, but in the kind of months beyond, you know, where's his career going to go in terms of singles? But it's very easy to lose perspective quickly on how quick this turnaround's been, you know. Just 5 months ago, we were pretty much retiring this guy. And for him to then be back at Wimbledon, potentially can win mixed doubles with Serena, I mean, that'd be a fabulous story if they both did that. And then, you know, hopefully he'll be back playing singles by the US Open. I mean, it was pretty much unthinkable. And I think the amazing thing from his perspective is that now he's completely pain-free. He's looking at getting back to the very, very top of singles. You know, he's not here just to kind of make up the numbers. He still has this kind of hunger and desire. And I think sometimes when you've been away from sport for a little period, and it's been a long period for Andy, really, since he's been playing without pain, you know, that hunger and desire will probably be even greater. And, you know, he's already shown he's not lost his tennis ability. That was never going to go. So a very hungry and determined Andy Murray should be a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, we're seeing Roger playing till he's 37. We could still have 5 years of Andy, maybe. I mean, that might be wishful thinking, but yeah, just a fabulous lift for British tennis, really.
What do you think, George, the regular doubles players make of Andy going into the doubles? Do you think they see it as a nice thing because it's more exposure for that side of the game? Or do you think they begrudge it a little, seeing the likes of Andy and Serena going in, you know, almost just to use it as something a bit extra?
I mean, the reception publicly has been pretty warm for the kind of first reason you said, you know, good exposure to the sport. I think, you know, mixed doubles isn't always actually taken massively seriously at the slams. So you do normally get a few kind of random pairings in there, you know, like Nick Kyrgios played this year with someone whose name I can't actually pronounce. I'm not even going to try. But that was, you know, that kind of gives you an insight. You know, Jamie Murray teamed up with Victoria Azarenka last year. You know, singles players do quite often turn up for the mix for a bit of, not just a laugh. I mean, they do want to win, but it is kind of seen as a bit informal. But what I would say about Andy is, you know, he's in that competition to win it. You know, he's he's lost in the men's now. He is really determined to win, and Serena doesn't enter tournaments if she isn't thinking seriously about winning them. So I think the fact they're taking it really seriously, they want to win it, you know, the amount of attention it's getting for mixed doubles, I don't see too many negatives. And as far as I'm aware, there's not been too many people grumbling about it, but I'm sure there's always one or two who don't see the positives.
So in the men's singles then, we saw a big number of players go out in the early rounds. And we saw Zverev, Tsitsipas, a couple of others as well who were expected to go fairly deep into the competition. Who are you fancying? Is it the usual suspects, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, before the tournament, I think most people were pretty certain it would be one of Roger, Rafa or Novak winning it, and I'm pretty sure two of them will be in the final, really. I can't see Novak being stopped. I think the only person in his side of the draw who's even capable of beating him here is Raonic, and he's had his kind of injury trouble, so I'm not sure he'd be able to even show up and do that. So he's pretty confident. And then Rafa and Roger are on course for a semi-final meeting. So, I mean, I think that would be the dream, really, from this perspective. I think, well, most of us would. It's kind of the opposite of the women's game, really. Most of us want to see a new young player coming through, but it's been a total disaster from that side of things on the men's side, while the women are getting someone coming completely out of nowhere. So I think it's definitely about time for one of these young guys to really push through, but unfortunately it won't be Wimbledon. So I would go for a Djokovic-Federer final
George, just lastly, on that men's side, talk about wanting players to come through. You mentioned Rafa as well. I almost completely forgot to ask you about Nick Kyrgios. your take on that, because I loved it. Personally, I loved it. I love Nick Kyrgios. He is a character, to say the least, a maverick of a man. But I can understand why people wouldn't like him if they're tennis fans. But I can also understand why tennis players wouldn't particularly like him, because he's a guy of obviously enormous talent. He hasn't even got a coach. It doesn't take it particularly seriously. Says he'd rather be a basketball player than a tennis player. But at the same time, I can't help but be completely kind of captivated. And when he's doing his post-press conference, I mean, that one afterwards, and he was openly admitted to trying to hit Rafa with the ball and saying, why should I care? I loved it. What do you make of Nick?
Yeah, I'm with you. I love him. I think he is kind of like Marmite, but I think tennis has slipped into a bit of a trap of being quite straight-laced. A lot of, I love sharing the court with this person. And what it really needs is guys like Nick who turn up and don't give a toss, really. Yeah. You know,
do all the players on the tour hate him?
No, he's actually quite popular.
Because I know him and Andy get along, don't they?
Him and Andy get on, yeah. He's quite popular among the young guys. I mean, you know, he's the sort of person who will rub certain people the wrong way. I mean, him and Rafa is a brilliant matchup in the sense they couldn't be more kind of polar opposites. You know, Rafa's like a really straight-laced, hard-working guy who's achieved so much. You can't imagine even training without giving 120%. And Nick just won't put in any effort. He's so naturally gifted and talented, it's kind of scary in many ways. And they rub each other up the wrong way. Kyrgios is kind of tossing insults at him. Rafa is a little more guarded, but he's also not afraid to kind of speak his mind on him, saying they're never really going to be kind of good friends and stuff. So, you know, I think the only bad thing from my perspective for Kyrgios is he doesn't set up these matches often enough. And that's because he's losing in matches where he's not trying and stuff like that. You know, this was a godsend in the sense that it was only a second round match. But I mean, what we really want from Nick is for that to be a semi-final, because it will give it so much more exposure, having Kyrgios kind of playing brilliant tennis all week and then taking on the big guys. And, you know, what other players don't do is get in the top guys' heads. So then Kyrgios goes into those matches so up for it, so ready to beat them, show them no respect. You know, he's talked about if he beats Novak again, he'll do his celebration, you know, that kind of throwing the cup of love sort of thing. I mean, that would just be absolute box office if he did that. But, you know, we need to get him setting up these matches in the first place. So, you know, it's the age-old quote, isn't it, that we all want him to kind of make the most of his talent. I'm not too bothered from that perspective. I think he's interesting as he is, but I just want him to see him getting into more positions where we can see him against the big guys and kind of build the story of this rivalry, because he is a fantastic watch, box office, even if you love him or hate him, you just can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, George, really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us this evening.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. There we are, top man, George Belshaw there, tennis expert, looking back on the week that's gone. Coco Gauff, Andy Murray, Roger Federer, and of course, the enigma, the maverick that is Nick Kyrgios. Marmite, whether you love him or hate him, chalk and cheese, him and Rafa. But yeah, just such entertaining, isn't he? Both on and off the court. Anyway, need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be speaking to James Rowe, a Dutch football expert. Big story from the Sky Bet Championship was Frank Lampard joining Chelsea. And Lee said, Frank Lampard joining Derby. I'm so used to saying Frank Lampard's Derby. So Frank Lampard has now left Derby, of course. You know this. He's gone to Chelsea. I'm just saying it out loud to get it clear in my own head. And in is the Dutch football legend, Philip Cocu. So we'll be speaking all about him next with James Rowe.
For the fans, by the fans, Love Sport Radio.
And it is the Love Sport Review with myself, Jake Watson. This show on till 8 p.m. And then afterwards, we've got the AFC Wimbledon fan show. And then 9 till 10, Graham Butler, former Leyton Orient man, is going to join me in the studio. We're going to talk about some transfer rumours. A couple of transfer or some football stories to bring you up to date with today. Tyrone Mings, he was on loan from Bournemouth at Aston Villa last season. Aston Villa, of course, promoted. Well, they have now agreed a deal at around £25 million. Seems a lot, doesn't it? But that is a going rate for an English defender, particularly as well. Between two English clubs, the fees are always inflated. And some great news for Fulham fans today. Alexander Mitrovic has signed a new contract at the club. There was speculation whether he would be playing in the Championship next season. I think we can all accept he's better than that, but he sees his future at Fulham and he's committed to signing a new contract. So wonderful news this evening for Fulham fans. Alexander Mitrovic will be a Fulham player next season. Right, so let's look back. Another big story from the week. Frank Lampard left Derby, gone to Chelsea, and Philip Cocu, the Dutch legend, has gone to Derby. I think a hell of a coup for a Championship club. A Dutch expert, Dutch football expert, James Rowe, joins on the phone now. Very good evening, James.
Good evening, Jake. How are you?
Yeah, no, I'm very, very well indeed. Look, I think this is a heck of a signing for Derby. If Derby fans were chuffed about getting Frank Lampard initially, they were probably a little bit scared. It's scary when you lose a manager you don't want to lose about who comes in to replace him. I feel this is as good as it possibly could have been in terms of an outcome for Derby, do you think?
I agree. I think it's a coup for both, really, for the club first and foremost, and also for Philip Cocu as a manager. He had a very solid 5 years here in the Netherlands at PSV, winning 3 Eredivisie titles in 4 seasons and a Dutch Cup. He then, before he moved on from PSV, he was linked to a move to the Bundesliga, which didn't really materialise. And then he had a stint at Fenerbahce, which only lasted around 16 games. But the biggest problem was the differences in Dutch football culture and Turkish football culture. And he was biding his time, I think, in order to make the right choice in order to get back into football management. And I think he's going to relish the challenge at Derby.
So the question for me is why he's gone to the Championship? Because you mentioned he was most recently at Fenerbahce. We all know what a huge club that is. Now, yeah, clearly it didn't work out, but you mentioned what he achieved at PSV beforehand. I just feel that he surely could have got a job, or he certainly would have thought he would have got a job at a top league. Is this because he's so excited by the project at Derby, or because nobody was going to give him a chance at a top club again?
No, I think it's the first option. I think managers now, especially with the law of England, I mean, you see with Marcelo Bielsa going to Leeds last season, you know, we've reached the stage now where the clubs are becoming bigger, even the clubs with rich histories, you know, wanting to get back into the Premier League, able to attract big names. And I think Cocu just wanted to take some time out and recharge his batteries and look at what he maybe did wrong. And he's very pragmatic as a manager. He's very calm. He's very concise. And I think he'll get Derby. I think they'll have a good season. And I think you'll see a very pragmatic Derby County in the coming months ahead.
Yeah. And it'll be very interesting to see how they do because it felt like they were going in a good direction under Frank. So it's going to be a big change. Do you think there'll be a big change in the way that Philip will set them up, or would he try to bring this Dutch style to the Championship, or do you think he'll try to alter it to try and be a successful side in the Championship, because he's not managed or played in this country before?
No, but he's an extremely intelligent manager, and I can't see him reverting to the typical Ducks style immediately. I think first and foremost he'll assess what squad he has and try to make the best of the in terms of getting the best 11 on the pitch to function as a team and build a base upon which to work from. But also when you look at his playing career, playing making many appearances, I think it was over 250 for Barcelona.
Yeah.
And he was also one common denominator, Jake, is when he made over 100 appearances for the Netherlands national team. And in many different squads, Euro 2004, for example, he was lauded for his motivational skills and his leadership by older players and also younger players. So he's got great motivational skills as well. And as I say, I think he'll want to be a success at Derby. And I think he signed a four-year deal, but I think this is definitely a project for the long haul for both the club and him.
Yeah, so do you think he's always been destined to go to the top as a manager, or we're still kind of a little bit unsure? Because, you know, it's often, perhaps sometimes unfairly, a stick that is thrown at people coming as a footballer from the Dutch league is, it's quite a weak division. You know, there's only a couple of teams in there, you know, who are particularly strong. You know, he's already obviously moved away as a manager and it didn't work out. Are there still question marks, do you think, over just how good he is?
No, I don't think so. Certainly not here in the Netherlands. I mean, obviously with his experience at the World Cup as well in 2010. And I'm in a fortunate position, Jake, where I interview Dutch players and managers on a regular basis for World Football Index. And when you interview managers that ply their trade here in the Netherlands at the lower echelons of the league and they build up, you know, it's about stepping stones and it's about making sure you make the right decision. And you see, for example, Jaap Stam is the new manager of Feyenoord, and maybe that will come to the fore in the season ahead. But managers, they like here in the Netherlands to find their feet and to theoretically improve and gain more and more experience before taking the plunge elsewhere. And you saw that particularly with Cocu in his five-year stint at PSV Eindhoven. You know, it was very much his team. He brought through young players and his stamp was very much on this team, where it was a team that would fight for one another and take responsibility for one another. And you could see that it was a success from top to bottom, which he managed to oversee.
While I've got you, James, the Netherlands women were, of course, in action today in the World Cup final. What did you make of their journey?
A tremendous journey. I mean, I've been extremely fortunate, Jake, to interview five of the starting lineup that started that final this afternoon in France. And this group of players are reigning European champions. And they've been on a tremendous journey together, where there's so much belief and so much togetherness. And you see how much they're willing to fight for one another. I mean, they won six games in a row and obviously winning the European Championships before then, there was so much belief. But the country is very proud of their achievements. You know, they've put their own mark on it. Women's football is gaining momentum in this country. And this group of 23 players are providing incentives for the next generation. It's just they came up against a very, very good United States team. And the small details at the highest level can often be decisive.
Yeah, so explain how this has happened, that the Netherlands have won, they came in as the European champions and they've made the World Cup final. But was this their second or first World Cup?
I believe it was the second one, if I'm rightly off the top, if I remember off the top of my head. But you see how one thing that you also have to understand, Jake, is that not just in the women's game, but also in the men's game, the Netherlands, with their failure to qualify for Euro 2016 and the World Cup in 2018, it was very much points of the generation of players coming through and the characters coming through in kind of like a wave form. And in the case of the ladies team, the squad has so much depth and so much quality of players playing for many, many European teams, top European teams. Lynette Bierenstein plays for Bayern Munich ladies, for example. I believe Jackie Groenen is going to sign for Manchester United. And we know of Miedema playing for Arsenal and Van der Donk as well. So you see them playing at a very high level domestically. And they also have so much fun playing together. You know, I liking the squad that the Netherlands have at the moment in the ladies' sense to be like a real group of friends, not just a squad meeting up to say, oh, hi, how are you? Nice to see you again. It's a real tight knit community, and they've done themselves proud and their country proud. And they'll go into the reaching the final four, and they qualified for the Olympics in Tokyo next year, which they were also very proud about in terms of an achievement. And I think that will be the next goal for this Dutch ladies national team.
Okay, top stuff. James, really appreciate your time this evening, mate.
You're more than welcome. Look forward to next time.
Thank you very much. That's James Rowe, Dutch football expert, talking about the Philip Cocu appointment at Derby, Skybet Championship Club, with a Dutch football legend in charge. It'll be very interesting to see how that one plays out, of course, because you know, he's never played, managed in the country before. And then also a little word on the Netherlands in the World Cup final today against the USA, losing 2-0. But a really good story for them, the European Championships, European champions, and then now World Cup finalists as well. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to flip back round. We've been talking about Derby and that Philip Cocu. Well, of course, we know that Frank Lampard is the new Chelsea manager. Rumours have it that Derby have applied to the EFL to have their name back. No longer are they Frank Lampard's Derby County. It is Frank Lampard's Chelsea. We're going to be speaking to Jonathan Kidd. Kidd has been on this station many, many, many times. You know the voice. He's got loads of them. He's a very, very entertaining man. He's from the Chelsea Fancast and from the Chelsea Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio.
From Ali to Zaha, we've got it covered. Love Sport Radio.
Yeah, welcome back to the Love Sport Review with Jake Watson, looking back at the big stories from the week. We've done Wimbledon and we've done Philip Cocu to Derby. We'll do in a few moments' time Frank Lampard to Chelsea. Just discuss how we think that's going to go. What kind of reception? How much patience? How much time? It's a really interesting time, isn't it, for Chelsea as a football club. I mean, I say interesting, it is. They've got a two-transfer window ban. You know, there's no Eden Hazard. They, of course, obviously can't bring players in, but they've now got arguably their greatest player of all time in charge of the football club. But he only has 1 year's experience as a manager. It went pretty well, but questions are there. And it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. And we all know Chelsea as a football club, incredibly unique. The most successful club in this country over the last 20 years, won more trophies than anyone else. But it has been a conveyor belt, hasn't it, of managers over the years under Roman Abramovich. If you don't win a trophy or a couple of trophies within the first season, you tend to not last much more than that. Will Frank be given that time? It'll be really interesting to see. Just to update on a couple of transfer stories as well this evening. West Ham have told Celta Vigo they're willing to pay his €50 million release clause for their striker, Maxi Gomez. But the reports are he wants to stay in La Liga. Everton also interested in him as well. And I also told you earlier, Tyrone Mings is set to sign for Aston Villa on a permanent deal at around £25 million. And Fulham striker Alexander Mitrovic has signed a new contract until 2024. He'll be staying at the club next season. Right, let's talk Chelsea then and Frank Lampard. Jonathan Kidd from the Chelsea Fancast on the phone now. Good evening, Jonathan.
Hello. How lovely to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
You're too kind. So, look, quickly, Jonathan, are you bored of talking about Frank Lampard yet, or are you not?
No, not particularly. No, you know me. I was a Sarri fan to an extent. I felt that everybody was a bit horrid to him. But I think this is a new manager. This is a new, completely new perspective. It's got this man is a PR. He's brilliant at PR, isn't he? He's a PR god. Mm. He photographs well. You can film him. They're already making promos with him, wandering into the club, and they're showing promos of the whole process of making the promo with him. And he's got a sense of humour and he communicates well. I mean, it's so completely different from the previous manager, except the previous manager was probably tactically streets ahead of him, but never got an opportunity really to fulfil it at the Bridge. But no, I'm happy to talk about him because he's brought back an enormous feel-good factor. And in fact, the game against Leicester City is going to be a phenomenal experience for everybody. There'll be emotions will be high in the positive sense, most positive way. You know,
yeah. I mean, that's my birthday that day. Leicester.
Is it?
Yeah,
I'll think of you. I'll think of you when I'm cheering.
I'll be there. I'll be there for sure. Not in the posh seats.
Oh, okay.
Not in the posh seats where you are.
No, but won't you be? Can I wave at you down in the chaffy seat?
Yeah, of course you can, mate. Of course you can. Look, Chelsea can't sign any players at the moment, which of course you know, and I'm sure you're probably sick of talking about that. But what I want to know, mate, of the players there at the moment, perhaps ones who are frozen out by Sarri, or the young players that we know are now kind of got no option but to play. Who do you think is going to be kind of the standout person who's going to be forced?
Is that the case? Is that the case? I have a terrible feeling that the team that plays against Man United will resemble the team from last year. I can't really see it changing. They're all decent players, most of them. You know, it'll get them playing in a slightly different system. They'll play. I wouldn't be surprised to see Azpilicueta playing centre half, actually, because he couldn't play right back at all under Sarri, because he didn't play there under Conte. So, and if Reece James, I think, seems to me the one possibility of making it into the possibly into the first team. I'm not convinced any of the others will get an opportunity. I mean, we're dealing, nearly all of them are internationals.
Yeah.
And they're all, you know, they're all top players. That's why they won the Europa League. This bizarre feeling that somehow they're all going to be ousted by the youth is just on, is planet cuckoo land. You know, it's not going to happen. Luiz is going to play centre half. Christensen may not get in if Dave plays there. And then it'll be Rudiger. So there'll be no place for Tomori. There'll be no place for... And even Ampadu, I think, deserves it more than anybody else. I'm not convinced he'll get in. But all will be discovered, won't it, when Frank makes his decisions as to which players go in and go out. I mean, I don't think Drinkwater has a, you know, cat's chance in hell of playing, because they've now got too many midfield players. And this is, having said that, though, we're waiting for Hudson-Odoi and Loftus-Cheek to come back into the team. But he's still got all these other internationals to pick. I mean, it's just interesting to see if anybody does get an opportunity to play. I think he'll be good at introducing them as the season goes on. But I think that the team's going to resemble what we saw last year, possibly with a better emphasis on passing the ball more quickly, because that was what became turgid under Sarri. And also, perhaps he'll get Giroud working better. Perhaps the crosses will come in, because I think Giroud is going to be the centre forward. I'm not convinced that Abraham. I think Abraham will be in the squad, but I think Giroud will still be the one to be playing against Man United.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think that too much has been made of these transfer bans then? Because
I don't think the transfer ban's got much to do with it. You know, they can still play with the team they've got. I don't think they're good enough. I don't think Giroud's good enough for the system. I don't think some of them are good enough. Zappacosta was never good enough. And they should have then, a new manager coming in who wasn't Frank, who didn't have the transfer ban, would have demanded bring his own players. So you wouldn't have the accessibility to the youth that Frank is going to give them. But I think it should be a good thing for the club to have this team, and also having Petr Cech playing from the old squad as well. And bringing up, apparently Eddie Newton's being brought up into the team, into the coaching team, and he's been dealing with all the loanees. I think it'll make this contact with all these players from the academy that much more relevant, rather than having a foreign manager coming in who doesn't know anything about the club. I think one of the big things about Frank is that, you know, it's that awful thing people have been saying, he gets it, he knows what the fans want, and he's a great communicator. You can see that's one of the things he's so much better than previous managers, because they couldn't speak English well enough, so they never ever quite gave enough of their personality.
Yeah, and another thing that's been spoken about or made out a lot of is the fact that there are now so many Chelsea legends or former Chelsea players as part of this setup at the football club, and almost a presumption. You said earlier about, you know, the transfer ban and also this presumption that the young players will now be played. Well, yeah, you know, it kind of is a presumption, isn't it? But a similar thing can be said with regards to a change in strategy. Now these former players are there. Are you convinced that this is what's going to happen? That there's going to be a complete change in the way that your football club is run with regards to looking for the future and patience?
Perhaps the board has noticed that there was a thing. That's why they've made these appointments. That's why there is this continuity that wasn't there before. And I think from a fan's point of view, it's immensely positive, because they'll be given a chance. The dilemma is he has to come up with trophies, because Chelsea are a trophy-winning side. But there'll be a kind of period of grace because of the transfer ban, and because he's Frank if he doesn't do terribly well. But I think he will. I can't see. I think the main thing is trying to put pressure on City and Liverpool. Because they're a top six squad regardless, and they're just too good. Some of them, you know, it's a question of how he gets them playing and whether they respond to him. But they should do. I can't see why they shouldn't. He knows most of them anyway. He's played with some of them, so and he's got their respect because of the footballer that he was. He just has to prove himself as a manager. But if he, you know, he studied under Mourinho, so he's going to be able to get most of these players motivated. But I think his approach to attempting to play the ball quickly, and also Derby didn't seem as tactically committed to one plan in the way that Sarri was. But you know, Sarri was very dogmatic and stubborn, and I think I watched a couple of the Derby games. He wasn't the first just pumping the ball down the pitch and running after it, and they scored consequently, as well as trying to play 4-3-3, which he was earlier. So he's played under different under great managers who've played in different ways, and he's not an idiot. I think that's the major thing. I mean, for goodness sake, he's got a Latin GCSE, for goodness sake. he must be very bright. He needs to win. They need to play attractive football. And I think they'll have a go at doing that. And if there is an obstruction, as in the past, between communicating with the board, he won't have that problem at all, because he's loquacious enough to communicate with Marina Grabowskaia, and he's got Petr Cech there to do it for him as well.
Yeah. So if the season started tomorrow, looking at the squads you're up against, are you fairly confident it'd be a top four? I think you know, I'd have Chelsea in the top four. With United and Arsenal missing out at the moment for me.
Yeah, I think so. I can't, even if there is the transfer ban, I can't. As I say, the players are good enough. I'll repeat, one mustn't expect that he's going to instantly put Mason Mount in. You mustn't expect that. I think Tomori may be moved on, actually, because they've got a large number of centre halves. So I think, as I say, who wants the youth in will be disappointed, but they're good enough, and there would be that kind of feel-good factor you want, in the same way that Solskjaer had, that initially they may get by on that. It's just a question of harnessing that. I think it's a very positive thing given the transfer ban. I'm not convinced they would have appointed him if there hadn't been the transfer ban, but you never know with the club. It may be that they made a decision that they felt that finally Abramovich felt that you've got to use the success from the youth in some way and have a managing system, because of Jody Morris, obviously managing them in the youth, that allows them to be seen. I don't think that either Sarri or Conte ever looked at the youth, whereas Frank has made this an obvious part of his philosophy. Mm. So, and they have an abundance of decent youth players. I mean, really good. But it's that step up. But, you know, Odoi and
Loftus.
Loftus, yeah. Somebody went blank. and Loftus, they're... Loftus-Cheek, they're examples of what the youth can potentially do. I think Loftus-Cheek got better and better at the end of last season when given the opportunity, and I think is a star in the making. Actually, it's just a shame that he got so badly injured. Yeah. Let's see how he comes back. But I think it'll certainly be a joyous appointment. It is a joyous appointment, and he just has to maintain that feel good factor.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan, lovely speaking to you, mate.
And you too, mate. Thank you. Always good fun.
Right, we'll speak to him very soon. That was Jonathan Kidd from the Chelsea Fancast, also the Love Sport Chelsea show as well. Always good value is Jonathan, and by no means bored talking about Frank Lampard yet. It's just, you know, when you work in the media and this appointment just kept on going on and on and on, the imminence of it. It just never felt like it was going to happen. And we kept talking about it and kept planning shows about Frank Lampard getting appointed. We're constantly told by various sources, it's going to be announced within 48 hours and another 48 hours and another 48 hours. So it just got to the point, it's like, are people bored now about talking about Frank Lampard, but they're not. They're very, very excited indeed, are Chelsea fans, about one of their greatest, if not their greatest player, being in the dugout next season, Frank Lampard's Chelsea. This is Love Sport Review. When we come back, we're going to talk some women's football. Sophie Lawson, women's football expert, is going to join us on the phone.
Giving your team a voice, Love Sport Radio.
Welcome back. This is the Love Sport Review. Jake Watson with you up until 10 p.m. this evening. Up next, by the way, it's the AFC Wimbledon fan show. And then we've got the transfer rumour mill. Graham Butler, former Leyton Orient player, is going to join me in the studio and discuss the big stories. But as I said, we've been doing the big stories from the week with this show. Just to update you, by the way, a couple of stories today. Aleksandar Mitrovic, Fulham striker, has signed a new contract at the club. Quotes, he says, "This is my home and I'm really happy to sign a new deal." We just spoke to Jonathan Kidd from the Chelsea fan show here on Love Sport. Well, Dom Betts from the Fulham fan show has just tweeted, this is a quote, "We're going to walk the league." I've taken a picture of that, Dom, and we will see. But yeah, things looking good for Fulham as the season gets underway. But let's talk Women's World Cup now, shall we? It was the final today. The USA beating the Netherlands by 2-0, a record fourth World Cup for them. We always kind of expected it, didn't we? Sophie Lawson, though, a women's football writer, is on the phone with us now. Sophie, good evening.
Good evening.
So, the USA today, was it? Did the Netherlands put up too much of a fight, or was it kind of always inevitable that they'd eventually make the breakthrough and lift the trophy?
I think it was a bit of both. I think, yeah, even before they qualified for the tournament, the US were favourites, reigning champions, just the mentality of winners. But the Dutch, I think, arguably didn't have a good tournament, and many people expected them to crumble today, but they held on. Kept a clean sheet until the 61st minute when they conceded a penalty. But you've got to bear in mind, every game the US have played, they've scored within the first 12 minutes. So to be kept out until after the hour is an absolutely phenomenal performance from the Dutch.
Yeah, so is it fair to say, what my viewing of the World Cup was, that England were arguably the second best team in that tournament, just perhaps unfortunate to be on the USA side of the draw?
I think there are a lot of very good teams who are out here, but who didn't show their best or didn't show their best consistently. I think England were well capable of beating the US in their match, and it's the cliche that if you want to be the best, you've got to be the best, and England just didn't have it when they played them.
But everyone keeps saying how the US is just so far ahead, you know, that over in America, you know, soccer, as they call it, is viewed as a women's game as opposed to a men's, like it's so kind of dominant in this country, I suppose, around the rest of the world. I mean, are they really that far ahead? Because again, when the semi-final between England and the USA, I didn't think there was much in it at all.
There wasn't really at the end of the day, just a little bit more clinical finishing. But I think you've got to look at the US, who've been historically dominant. So they've got everything in place. They've got a very strong collegiate system that kind of brings players through so that they go straight into the league. And it's set up a little bit differently. The mentality is massively different. The culture is different. But what we're going to see, maybe not between now and the next World Cup, but I think the one after it, is a lot of teams, especially those in Europe, catching up simply because of the investment. So you take the pre-existing cultures, the pre-existing ways of playing football, with all the players coming through being inspired, and you add professionalism to that and players who can play full-time, and that gap will diminish.
Mm. Are we convinced, by the way, that Phil Neville is taking them on and that they're a much better team than what they say they were under Sampson 4 years ago?
Oh, I really hope no one from the FA is listening. We are not convinced.
You're not convinced?
I'm not. I think he it was his first ever major tournament. He showed how green he was this summer. He's going to have the Olympics next summer, and that's going to be a big litmus for how much he's learned this tournament and how much he might be progressing, because we assume the Team GB will be predominantly English players, but hopefully, you know, we do see the best of British, the best of Great Britain in that tournament. But it doesn't feel like that. In some respects, the team has progressed under Neville. I think the mentality, and there's definitely more confidence in the team. But I don't think, when you look at how they performed 4 years ago under Mark Sampson, with this summer, it doesn't feel like, in football terms, they've progressed.
Very, very interesting indeed. Sophie, thanks for your time this evening. We have to leave it there.
Of course.
There we are. Sophie Lawson, women's football writer there, for her take on England. She thinks that actually possibly, potentially, have regressed under Phil Neville. She mentioned Mark Sampson, by the way. He's actually now back in football. He's got a job again. He's in men's football. He's at Stevenage as the first team coach there. He's going to be working for Dino Marmria. He's the head coach there. Anyway, this has been the Love Sport Review. We've been talking Wimbledon. We've been doing Derby. We've been doing Chelsea. And as you've just heard, the Women's World Cup. Coming up next here on Love Sport Radio, we're going to turn our attentions to some fan shows. We're going to be joined in the studio by the guys from the At 9 Years podcast for the AFC Wimbledon Fan Show.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.